thought what I'd do is just tell you what's on my mind, and we'll do some questions. A lot of what I'm telling you, I'm in the real world. I just came back from seeing people in Europe. I get more help generally from intelligence officials in Western Europe than I do from my own country, which isn't a surprise. Nothing's changed in this administration. You know, I voted for Obama. I have to tell you, I'll vote for him again, like a lot of you people here holding our nose, whatever we're going to do, we're going to vote for him because the alternative, you know, is some Tea Party wacko. Well, no. I'm not looking, you know, I mean, they could do something rational. The guy in Massachusetts is a rational guy, but I just don't know how they're, given the track record for the last week and with the FAA and all these issues, it's hard to see how they're going to do something. They're going to nominate somebody rational. If they do, it's going to be a anyway, that doesn't mean it's, you know, Obama's got a very tough road. He won 8 states that Democrats usually don't win. And, you know, he's got to win a bunch of states that are going to be very tough for him. He's not going to get West. He's not going to get Virginia again. And we can go through them all, but basically it's going to be tough. And it's going to be a nasty, bitter election. On the other hand, Obama, you know, it's sometimes I just think, as bright as he is, words have no meaning for him. He'll spend the last 10 days telling us that we're going to get this deal on the deficit. We're going to get it done, and we're going to have revenue. We're not going to do a deal unless we get revenue, unless we get some taxation and tax funds. And when he settles the deal without it, he pretends as if this is a great victory. And so it's like the words he had said 5 or 6 times in speeches the week or two before don't mean anything. And it's sort of a strange place to be, particularly now when we're really in trouble. I had a lot of time today in the airplane, so I read the New York Times. I worked there for 10 years in the 70s. It's still the best newspaper probably in the world, but sometimes it's not consciously pretty funny. Today they have a piece. It's the government's discovered that the headline is "To Fight Radical Islam, We Want Muslim Allies." And so guess what? We rolled out yesterday for the press corps an 8-page. It was a whole 8-page strategy document that had this, that we want to now make nice to the Muslim community. And we discovered because of what happened in Norway the other week that sometimes right-wingers, and you've got to remember McVeigh and Nichols of Oklahoma City, sometimes right-wingers are crazy, do bad things too. They're not always Muslim. And as part of this new policy, I'm going to read you a sentence that is absolutely, I don't know. It's bathos, camp pathos, I don't know what it is. It's over the top. The strategy calls for, this is dead seriously, calls for the federal agencies to support state and local officials by sharing information on potential threats and cooperating closely with the police. Wow. That's the strategy. I don't know what the hell we've been doing. I just don't know. But anyway, it's a very high camp piece because it's so silly. Muslims, if you did polling in the 1990s, were mostly Republican, fanatically loyal to America, really loved the idea they could live anywhere, be different, as long as they cut their lawn and their kid played varsity soccer in the local high school, they were accepted in the neighborhood. That's always been the way America is, always the way it has been, and always the way it still will be, despite all the trauma. And so the notion that somehow it's a special community and it was isolated so much by us and so much racism was thrown at him by the Bush administration. I think Obama's done much better on this, but it's just pretty amazing that we could fall so easily into the trough. What drives me nuts, as somebody who's very fanatic about, you know, interested in foreign policy and spent a lot of time, I go back and forth to the Middle East. I don't speak their language, but everybody's tolerant of all of us Americans who don't speak languages. What's missing in all the debate, in 68, I came back, I was a kid reporter covering the Vietnam War, and you didn't have to be a rocket scientist, you just had a watch to know this war was crazy, it was a losing war, we weren't going to win it, we were killing a lot of people needlessly. Every officer you talked to, and I talked to a lot of officers, up to two stars, all privately said it's madness, the same thing you hear about Afghanistan and what's going to happen in Iraq next year, the same thing you hear about Libya from all the officers, they just said, wow. not the ones that, not but the Petraeuses and the ones that testify. There seems to be sort of an understanding that anybody who goes before the Congress and anybody who goes at a news conference with somebody senior in the White House or in the State Department, why, truth is the last thing they're going to tell. That's just the way it is. I don't know why we accept it. I think we have a bad deal in America, by the way. You know, all of us, everybody here, we're parents. We don't lie to children. We don't want children to lie to them, with maybe the exception of 13-year-old girls, because you have to be realistic. But anyway, but not boys. But anyway, but basically, that's what we want. We live with another, a wife or another person, whatever relationship, and the whole thing is dependent on trust. And we all, everybody in America, everybody in the world, your life goes along with, you have a core relationship that depends totally on trust. And this is how we live our life. When it comes to dealing with the national security state and our government, we understand we're not going to get that. We understand we're going to have a Nixon, we're going to have a Kissinger, we're going to have a Bush, we're going to have a Cheney. I'm doing a book on Cheney. And my biggest problem is, how's anybody going to believe some of the stuff I'm finding? You know, I don't have a video camera of it, but it's pretty out there. He did change the world for us in a way that's very profound, the secret world. And I'm not talking about Wikipedia. They can keep secrets, this government, in ways you can't believe, a lot of secrets, most of the secrets they can keep. And so, which gives them enormous freedom to operate. But so here we have this system where the things that are most valuable in our personal life aren't something that we even expect or demand from our leadership. We know they don't tell us the truth. We don't get the whole story. It's a bad bargain for the Commonwealth. It's just a bad bargain, and we live with a bad bargain. And that's the way it is. And what I try and do is as a journalist, I try and not go with the narrative, but that has problems too, because the narrative is comfortable and it's easy. We see the narrative all the time in the major newspapers. The narrative drives it. The narrative about we might muddle through in Afghanistan, or the narrative about the war in Iraq might be okay. We haven't done it in folly. So in 67, 66, 67, I'm most of the time covering the Pentagon, but I'm also over there. And it's a lose-lose. And so I left reporting and went to work for a guy named McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy, running for the president, a guy from Minnesota, very straight-laced, very interesting, very bright. He was a Benedictine. His favorite author, some of you may know this guy, when I was a speechwriter initially, and I said, what's your model? And he said, a guy named Charles Peguy. He was a 20th century theologian who wrote in most exasperating, distant prose. And that's the way he was. But what did he talk about? Why did the kids get clean for Gene? Some of you remember that. Why did they rally to them? In part because he was against the war. But what was he saying about the war that was so interesting? He was saying it was immoral. He was talking about morality. He was talking about international morality. That's off the table now. I mean, nobody, we talk about maybe we can muddle through in Iraq. Nobody talks about the moral, the enormity, to use that word right, of what we've done into Iraq, the destroying a society, changing, completely overthrowing. It's a complete chaotic society. Do we have a moral obligation to do more than just say we're going to walk away, which we have to? We'll talk about that. So these are some of the things that drive me nuts. And we glide on. And I don't see this White House caught up in a notion of morality. And I know, it's, you know, yeah. Bring out the violins and all that stuff. But we're in a situation now where, I'll tell you what's going on. Robin Wright, who really knows what she's talking about, it was very upbeat, I presume here too, in the latest book. I haven't read all of it, but I read parts of it. And I'm very upbeat about the Arab Spring. And she's dead right in this sense, in this very important sense. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's the kids rallying, oh, yes, Facebook and YouTube and what is that stuff on the Internet? Right, okay. That's, you know, my children, like your children, and all the young people I know, voicemail's gone. They don't check voicemail anymore. It's all texting. They don't check voicemail. I'm sure you'll find leaving a voicemail for a child is a dead letter. It's got to be voicemail. And so it is. Times have changed enormously. And that also leaves a lot of opportunity for manipulation, too. And I'm not suggesting that our intelligence services can use this in ways that are very sophisticated too. And and this obviously is so. I'm just saying some of the stuff you may hear when you hear about dissent and revolution, some of it may be propaganda or agitprop, but certainly in Egypt, and certainly in Tunisia, it was not. And so this was a great moment. It was the worst thing that ever, I'm sure Robin got into this. It was a big blow for the fanatical, the Salafis and what we call Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's been done. He's been done for years. Long before he was killed, he was done. And Al-Qaeda, per se, is always a footnote, but there's certainly Salafism is very important, Wahhabism that the Saudis support. And fanatical Sunnis are also out there. And this was a blow to them. It's very hard to rally young people to go and give up their lives for the potential of all those virgins up there when they think there's actually a chance they can have a say in the world. And that was great. So what's happened since then? And here's what I've been looking at. I'm telling you stuff I haven't written, and it'll probably end up in a book. But what's happened is there's been a counter-revolution. And the counter-revolution has been led by Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have been fanatically, and the Saudis have the money. You're giving them money every time you buy it. You fill up, you know, the $4. I don't know what it is here, but it's probably as much as it is in Washington, which is $4 minimum. At $110 a barrel, the Saudis have a lot of money to play with, and so do all the other sheiks. The Saudis have been leading an anti-kitty revolution. In part, the Saudis were shocked and dismayed at us, because we went back and forth about Mubarak, and that was one of their big stable enemies. What you have in the world is a major Sunni-Shia divide. You have the Shia who control Iran. Iran's now the big, once again, it's the big Hitler. We love Hitlers. We've had a million Hitlers. Gaddafi was a Hitler for a long time. We had Mao. We had Stalin. We had Khrushchev was a Hitler. You just name it. I can name 100 Hitlers for us. We always sort of tend to darken those we don't like. And Bashar Assad is a Hitler. The Saudis are Sunnis, always had tension with Shia. This fight goes back 13 centuries. The leader of the most powerful man outside of the king right now, Abdullah, is Prince Naif, who's the interior minister, who's about 69. He's the youngest of the old crowd. They're all in their 80s. They're all doddering old fat men, not in good shape. And when he's probably going to be the next king. And he's basically, I can just tell you, the word racist comes to mind when it comes to Shia. He's very hostile to Shia and doesn't think they have the same standing, nearly the same standing as Sunnis do, obviously. And so they're interested in combating. One of the things they're doing is they're putting, I'll talk more about it, they're doing a lot. The government now in Iraq is led by Maliki, who's a Shia. We tried to get Alawi guy in, but it didn't work. Maliki has got a deal with the most radical of the Shia in Iraq, Muqtada Sadr group. And Muqtada Sadr is a fanatic fighter. You remember him from years ago, the one that always denouncing us Americans must leave. He's back in the country. He was in Iran for years. He's back there. And the constitution in Iraq says we have to leave on the 31st, and we're desperate not to do it for a lot of reasons. One is what's going to happen if we do leave. We're worried about a Shia Iran and a Shia Iraq. Both have great, enormous reservoirs of oil, if not as much as Iran. Not as much as Saudi Arabia, but collectively probably as much in terms of undeveloped reserves. There's a great deal of oil left in in Iraq that hasn't been exploited. And there's also reports of Saudi Arabia. Iran right now is the second largest producer of gas, and it also has a lot of on fields that have not been tapped because they're not the sanctions we have kept something like. Oh, I don't know, they need something like, they've estimated $60 billion to keep their fields going. And so we have a policy, it's a really, from one way of looking at it, the hostility, we share the hostility towards Iran, which with, people estimate, I was just talking to oil people, as I said, in Europe 2 weeks ago, people estimate in 5 years with $60 billion, Iran could go from the what it was, it's under $2 billion a day, something like that, could go to $4 or $5 billion. Iraq, if it were ever developed correctly, could produce a lot more oil. Libya, which was, for some reason, we decided we're now going to go after Gaddafi, and we've started this insane mess. I can guarantee you right now, NATO wants out of this. NATO wants out of Libya. NATO wants out of Libya, the Western countries. They want out of Afghanistan. They got no money. They're on the edge of a bank default. The crisis we've had with our banks is still facing the Western banks because they're all valuating. They've all did the same thing. Everybody, all bankers got greedy. That's a definition of a banker. And they all got greedy when the real estate was booming, and they all got deeply in, like our banks. They're all right now. They're carrying trillions of dollars worth of real estate at pretty much par book value. When of course its value is nil or close to it. It's all underwater. The banks are basically underwater, and so that's why the Greeks will never fall. A lot of you people know a lot more about it than I do. The Greeks, they'll never let Greece go down because if it does, it could start a chain where you could see, Portugal's in trouble, Spain's in trouble, then it'll spread into Western Europe. The banks are in a frightening position there. So there's no money. And so there's no money for these wars. And not only that, Gaddafi, crazy as a loon as he was very tough on jihadists, very tough on Islamists. And Gaddafi also produce 1.4 million barrels of very light oil for Southern Europe, for the French, and most particularly for the Italians. And all of their refineries are designed for this light oil. So they have a tremendous dilemma. Do they start buying dirty or more oil with more foreign elements in it from places like Russia and other, which would involve changing the process of how you refine stuff? So we could probably solve all of our oil problems if we just decided we didn't want to go to war anymore, that we can't afford anyway. But of course, this is another world of logic and sensibility that just doesn't exist. So, Saudis are leading counter-revolution. What are they doing specifically? They're spending money. The Saudis, I would guess, and again, it's hard to write a history about what the Saudis do because we don't know that much about it. It's a secret society in a way. But certainly after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the Saudis began to spend more money on madrasas, the schools and education. They got very worried that they were going to be the underdogs, the Sunni-Shia. It's a tremendous issue. The Sunni-Shia issue in the Middle East is just huge right now. It always has been. It's more intense now because Iran is sailing. I don't know if you noticed, IMF mentioned that the Iranian economy, despite our sanctions, has grown by 3.2% last year, something that was a number like that. And I don't know, we keep on hearing about how sanctions are great, but, Fidel Castro has been sanctioned for 62 years, and he seems to be doing okay. They're still there. I mean, it's not, the answer is, I wrote a piece about, the answer is to start talking to people. And if you got a problem with their nuclear, and they don't have bombs, everybody agrees they really don't have bombs. They may have ambitions, and they have a potential, but they're not doing it now. There's no question of that in the communities. They're not making bombs now. They have dreams of glory, maybe. But you can talk to them. They want to come to the West. They're dying. I'm telling you, right now, I deal with those. You can make a deal, but we're not going to do it. It's politically untenable. So the Saudis reacted to the spread of democracy in Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere by financing a snuffing out of it. In Egypt right now, the Saudis have helped and been working with the Muslim Brotherhood, which presented a shiny face to all of us in America during the Tahrir Square. They were very helpful. They took a back seat. They let the kids run stuff. We've basically, I don't know whether it's official policy or not. My understanding is that the Egyptians are very eager to share power with the Muslim Brotherhood, and we basically are not the Egyptian intelligence service, the Egyptian military, and we're basically going to go along with that because that's a known. They may be more Islamic than we want, but the kids aren't a known. The kids could really do things. They could change things, make more trouble for Israel than perhaps this new government I'm not sure that they're right, but that's the game. Same is happening with in Tunisia, where the Muslim Brotherhood probably will get 30-35% of the vote if they have an election. And they'll probably get a significant percentage of the vote in Egypt. And so the Muslim Brotherhood are back in play. And, you know, there is no question the Muslim Brotherhood changed. They weren't nearly as jihadist. They were more secular in Egypt. But they're still, the bottom line is that there's something to worry about, because they, right now, if you've been following the Egyptian thing, issue, there's one of the issues is they want a more, they've been calling for a more Islamic government, which isn't necessarily, you can be Islamic as they are in Turkey and still be run a secular government, but that's not clear it's going to happen. In any case, the bottom line is the kids are being squeezed out. That's why they're still marching. They're being marginalized. The Saudis are deeply involved in that. They're deeply involved in supporting all of the countries in the Gulf. We're talking about what they call the Gulf Cooperating Committee. I think it's the Gulf Coordinating Committee. It's a collection of the various states. Let me see. I wrote down a list because I can never remember all of them. Oman, UAE, that's Dubai and Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, where I hope you noticed the worst brutality we've had in the last year was in Bahrain, when the kids there started, mostly Shia. Bahrain's a country controlled by the Khalifa family. You know, we have all these magical kingdoms that started because they found oil there. There is the Saudi kingdom. The Saudi government was there. But some of these other places were just, they suddenly become, you know, 70, 80 years ago, they become multi-billionaires, and now they're sheikhs, and they're run very tightly. These are countries in which families in Kuwait and the emir in Qatar, they control everything. Everybody, they have certain people are citizens. The rest are serfs. Mostly in Bahrain, the largest majority of the country were Shia, who did the work. Just to be blunt about it, the Shia and the Palestinians in the Gulf, those countries, in Oman and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, and they're the Hispanics. They're the people who clean the toilets and do the jobs nobody else wants. But they're also large in number. And so the Arab Spring and our refusal to our back and forth in Mubarak and our finally acceding to his fall, and the reason we were so back and forth is because the game has been for 60 or 70, the British started this, the game has been once these little chiefdoms developed all the oil and they were taken over by the sheikhs and they became total kingdoms, dominate, you know, the farthest thing of democracy you've ever seen. Most of the people living there didn't have citizens' rights. Serfs, basically. We supported that. And the Bush administration did the same thing. While they were talking about democracy in Iraq, we were supporting them because the game is that these guys, if they give us bases, and they give us oil, and they give us gas, and sometimes they cut the price. Gaddafi was terrible that way. He always took 20% off the top. Other people didn't take as much. As long as they did that, we'd let them run the country any way they wanted. And so they all formed, about 30 years ago, early 80s, I think, they formed this defense group, the Gulf Coordinating Council, I think it's called, GCC. It's the only defense organization in history that we know of to defend from within. They're not defending against outside threats, it's from the inside threats of the kiddies who work there, the worker serfs doing stuff. So in Bahrain, when the crisis began, man, the Saudis rolled in their tanks and thugs came from Pakistan. And all these people came, and just it was the most bloody scene you ever wanted to see. Some of you are doctors or nurses. You've probably seen all the stuff reported. They were going after all the doctors and all the nurses brutally. It was really a bad time. This is early this year after Tahrir Square. And so the Saudis have spent a lot of money in Lebanon. There's a new government in Lebanon that's more or less progressive. It's different. It doesn't support the Sunnis. It actually has people who aren't terrified of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the number one terrorist group in the world, we've said, that has done very little terrorism in the last 10 years. They've worked politically. Nasrallah runs it. He's a very powerful man in the Middle East. He gives speeches and nobody here even reports him, but they're reported around the world. Believe me, he's one of the most important men in the Middle East, Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. We hardly know he exists. All we know about Hezbollah is that they were gangsters back 30 years ago. Yes, they were. They were very tough. They didn't blow up necessarily the Marine barracks because they weren't formed then, but people who later joined Hezbollah weren't formed about 85 or 86. In 83, the bombings took place. But people involved in that ended up in this radical group that was always against Israel and still is against Israel. We had a war in 06. The Israelis attacked southern Lebanon where Hezbollah was and were driven off, basically. Hezbollah's worked within politically, and so the new government recognizes that. And, of course, the Saudis have gone bitterly crazy about that. They support fanatical, radical Sunni groups, and where they've done most of the work in the recent months has been in Syria. No, I have no brief for Bashar Assad, who I always thought, I've seen him a number of times, was progressive, but he's acted, Syria was always the most repressed place in the world. Even in Egypt, you could organize a demonstration, you could have a political party, an opposition party. You couldn't do it in Syria. So they're really way behind the curve. On the other hand, in the last 10 years, it's also arguable that Bashar did some things. He opened up the internet, he opened up television to foreign news. He did some things, but basically he's a minority. He's a member of the Alawites, about 11-12%, and they control the country, largely Sunni, and many Muslim Brotherhood. And so what's happened is it's not quite as simple. There was certainly the Arab Spring started legitimate protests, and the people protesting should have been dealt with by the Bashar government years ago. They should have dealt with the protests. It was a terrible mistake to keep on ignoring them, putting them in jail. I would ask him about it, and he would always say that he's got to deal with corruption first. Then he can deal with the human rights issue. And many Syrians who are rational will tell me it's a bad mistake. They're certainly killing a lot of innocent people. But there's also another element that you never hear about. Much of the demonstrations were driven by Salafists and by Muslim Brotherhood. There's a serious threat to the regime that he's going to kill everybody to stop it. He's going to keep on killing. That's what he's going to do. There's a threat to the regime and a solution that's going to kill them. You know, he's his father's son, not for nothing. And so that's going to happen. Why don't we do more about it? Well, among other things, the consequences, everybody would rather have even a Bashar weaker in power because he's not irrational when it comes to international deals. He's had a relationship with Turkey. He's had a relationship with Iran. And there was a lot of, even in this White House, there was a lot of hope that in the second term, if they got one, that he would be a player in some peace process. It's not going to happen. He's going to be weak, and the Israelis don't want to see him go down because they don't want crazy Sunnis living, you know, coming into Syria. Who knows what kind of crazy, fanatical people there'll be? Probably very Islamic. So it's a lot more. You don't see. Please don't take this as a brief for what he's done. What he's done is horrible. And it's probably going to, but, you know, my guess is he's going to survive. He's going to kill a lot of people, and we're going to sit back because the alternative is worse. The Saudis right now also are spending, this is from American intelligence. I can just tell you the estimate is $2 to $3 billion. They've been buying small arms, AK-47s, and a lot of ammunition from Russia, which will sell to anybody, of course, Georgia, the Ukraine. They have a big border with Iraq. The Saudis are committed to making sure that Iraq does not stay Shia, that Iraq goes back into the Sunni fold. As you know, under Saddam, it was a Sunni, secular Sunni country. The Ba'athist Party, the Sunni Ba'athists in Iraq, always hated the Iranians. There was a lot of bad blood, along with dealing with their problems with the Kurds, too, in northern Iraq. But basically, the Saudis, I think you're going to see, the odds are, I would bet you're going to see a major, horrible civil war. Right now, we're pushing as hard as we can. The constitution agreed to by the Sunnis and by us, signed by them as their constitution, says we have to be out by December 31st. And if you read the paper every day, we're negotiating like hell to try and get some sort of residue force left there. We'll be security. We won't be military because, you know, the fear is that once we get out, and I think the only answer is if Maliki agrees to keep us there, Muqtada Sadr, who's on his left, the more radical Shia, will come after him. So it's a mess. He's probably going to get us to go out. We have a big embassy there. We have 17 consulates. There's 17 provinces, 17 consulates. I don't know how we're going to protect them. We'll probably have to fold them up eventually. We won't be able to protect ourselves there, and it's going to be a bloodbath. Maybe not, but I think the potential is very high for something very serious. So these are big things that we don't know much about. And I wish I could tell you that I wasn't empirical in what I know. I do know that the Saudis are spending a great deal of money. It's been reported. I don't know why we're not paying more attention to it. I don't want to go on and on because I could, because I want to do questions. But let me just go to a couple other countries. The Iranians, I mentioned. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker a couple of months ago in which I mentioned people like Tom Pickering, who was the deputy undersecretary of state, and then deputy, I guess he was deputy, a longtime ambassador, has been leading a group of what they call Track 2. This is a private, non-government group going back and forth into Iran, meeting with Iranian senior Iranian officials. And people like Pickering, who is no question about his cautiousness, he's extremely worried about the Muslim Brotherhood, too, appropriately. And no question about his he left the government. He went to work for Boeing. This is not some heretical guy. And he does very highly classified work in, I probably shouldn't say all this, but he's done some great stuff in secret for this government, some studies of problems and looked at some problems. He can't get to the President of the United States to talk about Iran. They just keep him isolated. Obama, you know, I'm told that Hillary considers it a boys club, a men's club around him. It's hard to get to him. He's surrounded right now, everything's pretty much political. And I guess maybe it should be, you know, maybe I'm naive to think it shouldn't be. But I think it shouldn't be. I think if he wants to be president the second term, I think if he does start doing the right thing, he's going to be president more than if he just keeps on trimming and hopes that he can convince enough independents and hold the African-American community and hold the Jewish community. He's got a percentage of those. Other problems, the Israelis, what are you going to do about the Israelis? They're moving to the right so fast, it's not funny. If Bibi goes down, and the next vice president would be Lieberman, some of you know who he is, and that's, you know, it's hard to think you can get something worse than Bibi, but you can. The big advantage is his English isn't as good. Bibi can come and really snow us here because he speaks perfect English, and we love that. Foreign leaders who speak English have a real good time here. They can come to the Congress, they can tell any story they want, they can be cheered. Narrative. What's her name? The lovely woman that got shot in the head in Arizona. Gifford. She comes back a couple of days ago to the Congress, and it's the story of for everyone. All the cable, 24-hour cable, and they all come and they greet her, the Republicans hug her. And does anybody say she's going back to a Congress that spent 20 years fighting against any ban on automatic weapons? No, because that's not the narrative. The narrative is a good time, good day. I mean, the hypocrisy of the Congress is breathtaking, only matched by the hypocrisy of the press and the hypocrisy of me and the hypocrisy of all of us. So the Saudis are doing stuff. Nobody calls them on it. I don't know why. It's hard to do it. They work in mysterious ways. Pakistan, I used to always, El Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Egyptian that won the Nobel Peace Prize, that was always sort of distrusted of by us because he was a Muslim. Although the paper today says we might not distrust all Muslims, according to the New York Times. You know, when I did Abu Ghraib, I got a buddy. You can't help but like the Israelis. And, you know, as an American Jew, I like the Israelis. I go there and I have friends there. I have this buddy who was a spook. He was a Mossad guy. I met him in the 80s in Washington. He lived in Chevy Chase, and he was in the export business. And every time I go to his house, some minister in the government or some deputy director of an intelligence service was always there. And he used to have fun inviting me. I once had, in 85 or 86, I saw him in a Georgetown restaurant with a guy that was the head of operations for the CIA at the time. And he's talking to him, and he waves me over, and I sit down, and it doesn't matter who the guy is. And they were, you know, having fun with me a little bit. And I said to the man that was head of the CIA, I said, "So what have you been doing?" He said, "Si, if I told you, you'd have to go to the U.S. attorney," he said. That's the attitude you have. It's still there. You know, when you have secret intelligence agencies and a Congress that's really very eager not to investigate anything, you have a lot of problems. We have a lot of problems in our military, although a lot of the people do it right, and a lot of people, there's a lot of bad stuff going on, as there would be in a war. I mean, come on, we're in a war in Afghanistan that every kid knows we can't win. The public is against them. They know that. And they're getting massacred. Most of the army units are 30-40% casualties in 6 months from bombs that go off below, bouncing Bettys. I don't know. I have to tell you what organs are being worried about. It's terrifying. And you never see an enemy. The Taliban don't march in uniforms. So you start making judgments inevitably in the field. You lose buddies. I was in the Army, and I can tell you the only thing you do in the Army, you're willing to die for your buddy, not for your flag. It's for your buddy. It's all payback. And so you get to that, and that's inevitable. And there's more of it than you want to know about, that I want to know about. And it's not worth making cases against people. It's just happening. So I don't know what we're going to do with Israel. Israel wants to bomb Iran now. They're back to that. They always want to bomb Iran. I don't know if just talk. I've been writing about it for 6-8 years. Talk about the sky is falling, you know, Chicken Little. But they're back to it. They want to do it, and there's some planning going on, and they're talking about it. I'll just end with this. Obama's got a real problem this fall. The UN is going to vote Palestine as a separate state, and that's going to happen in late September. The UN comes back around the 10th or the 11th. There'll be 2 weeks of language. Probably the vote will take place right by the end of the month. And Bibi's position, apparently, so I'm told, with the Americans is, hey, look the other way. You don't have to help me. Look the other way. If I hit a few things in Iran, no big deal. I'll take out a few things. Yeah, I know there's no smoking gun, but I'll slow down any devious plan they have. There's a facility called Natanz where they are, in their own clumsy, very incompetent way, enriching uranium. They're not very good at it. They have incredible contamination problems. But they are enriching. It's theoretically impossible, and theoretically possible that they could get enough in a couple of years to build a bomb. But then building a bomb is a lot. You know, you just don't say, I've got it. You have to fabricate a gas into a metal, and then you have to turn a gas, convert a gas, UF6, into a metal. And this all has to be done in a unit so secret, so sealed. Then you have to fabricate it into a ball, put it into a warhead, and have something that flies that really works. Most of their missiles, they brag about them, but we know they're not nearly as good. We do know that. They're not nearly as efficient as everybody says. But you don't want to take a chance. So Israel's position would be, hey, let me take a hit. They won't do much, the Iranians. They're cool. They'll figure out some, you know. It's not going to be the end of the world, and this will buy me time with my right wing. Of course, he is the right wing, but that's what his argument is. I'll buy time with my right wing. And if I get enough time and a little freedom on my right wing, I can cut a deal with the Palestinians. And then, Mr. President, you don't have to make a vote you don't want to make. What's he going to do with the UN? If he goes and supports Palestine as a state, he's going to lose a lot of New York money, New York Jewish money, and New York money for the campaign. If he doesn't, if he goes along with Israel and doesn't support it, he's going to lose more support from the base, his base that believes that he should be doing the right thing, which is something to get rid of this horrible problem that's been the genesis of so many of the problems. So I've been ruminating. You've been inside with me ruminating as I go through things. I had notes. I want to see if this, you know, none of which pays much. This is my airplane bill. Oh God, I just, the biggest thing I go and what I see when I go to Europe, besides seeing various European intel people who are smart, and the one thing about the intelligence people in Europe, they stay. The head of the German BND, he's gone now, he stayed 30 years. He was John Le Carré's best friend, and, you know, helped him write his books. Wonderful man. I'm a very tough guy too, but he had all that experience. And I also go see international oil people, because that's where it's at. The oil people, you know, that's, oil is it. You know, my friends in the oil business say to me, oh yeah, okay, talk to me about wind tunnels, talk to me about, you know, solar panels. What got you across the ocean? Was it wind, solar panels? Okay, as long as that's the way you're gonna travel, you're gonna need us. And so they are worried sick about what's gonna happen next year. If Israel does make a move, you could see a war. You could see a Middle East war. Everything's very tense right now, and it's much more fragile. And the Saudis are working their game, and they have a lot of money buying arms and doing stuff. And it's not, you know, and they have support. And there is this, you can see it, we're beginning to start this mantra about Iran. Iran now is killing Americans. We have that story again. Iran's now involved in Iraq, and they're doing stuff in Iraq, and there's more intelligence about Iran is doing, most of which came in different forms during the early years of the Bush administration. And I can tell you from seeing stuff, from having JCS analyses, most of it was highly exaggerated. The Iranians certainly played a big role, certainly supported elements, this Shiite elements. But the major elements doing most of the trouble in Iraq after we took over were Sunnis, were Sunni jihadists. And what happened is really simple. We disbanded the army. And officers in the army were disbanded. They were cut off. And you had generals that had been paying, I know one guy that was 28 years in the service, a three-star general, he'd been paying 8.5% into a pension matched by the government. That disappeared. And so they were left with no money. Nobody would give them any money except the fundamentalist Sunnis. These were Ba'athist Sunnis. And they would come to us, our officers, in 03, and say, "You guys, you've taken away my jobs. You've taken away everything." Half of them were selling fruit in front of their house from their garden. And this was in the early days before the things really fell apart in Iraq. This is the summer of 03. And they would say, "We're going to have to start doing things." They warned the UN 3 weeks before that they were going to do something. They warned us they were going to. The only people giving them money was what we call Al-Qaeda, Mesopotamia, the fanatical Islamist Sunnis were giving them the money to keep on living if they killed people for them. And the latest surge simply, when by 06, 07, we realized if we gave those people money, they would kill the bad guys for us. That was the surge. I mean, it was a change in policy. That did help. But it was sure slow coming. So we have a million questions. I'm here. I don't know. Let's see. When is party time here? Do you all go to bed at 8 o'clock so you can hike tomorrow morning? But we'll do questions.
Thank you, Cy, for start. The ushers and our volunteers will take questions, and if you give the questions to them, they'll be passed up. But let me start with one. You only said one word about Pakistan. Last week in another city in Colorado called Aspen, the White House advisor, Douglas Lute, former three-star general, was quoted as saying that what we really need is more covert action in Pakistan over the next 6 months so we can get rid of al-Qaeda, and that 6 months would do it. Do you agree, and should we do it?
Well, we're doing a lot now. I don't know. You know, we're doing a lot now. I hope none of you believe for one second that, you know, I mentioned Al-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, because I used to see him a lot when I went to Vienna. And he always used to say to me, "Why are you guys so nutsy about Iran when they're not there yet?" Admittedly, and he was mad at Iran. Iran had withheld some information. Nothing wonderful, but Iran was not anywhere near where Pakistan was. You've got a country that's full of crazy people that's got 40 to 60 bombs. This is 6-7 years ago. The last figures I saw were 120. They're continuing to run enrichment facilities and continue to generate highly enriched uranium and presumably continuing to fabricate warheads because they know how to do it. And so I will just tell you, I've written about 3 years ago, it's a major, major, major obsession with us and the Indians and the Israelis to do something about Pakistan in case of problems there and their nuclear weapons are jeopardized. We are not going to let that happen because we're really afraid of the old-fashioned word, the Islamic bomb. That was the story. That was the word. Books are written with that phrase a decade and a half ago. But it's back again. The Pakistanis are very unstable. And we are major league dirty tricks there, absolutely. It's been much harder because of the animosity, growing animosity towards Americans because of the bombing we do, the predator bombing. You know, I don't know why the government keeps on insisting that the bombs always go where they're aimed. The history never shows that they do. I mean, the bombs don't go where they're aimed. And, of course, when you're using intelligence on the fly and you're dropping bombs on people, in Pakistan, as in many places in the Middle East, even the insurgents, even the warlords, they live separately. The men live separately, but the women are just in a doorway, you know, a wall away. So when you bomb a home of an insurgent, you're killing a lot of collateral. It's a lot of collateral damage. The numbers are breathtaking. The internal numbers are significantly less in terms of percentage of the number of collateral deaths are much higher, as reported privately, than they are. So it's, and This is a policy that's a Bush-Cheney policy that Obama did nothing with. Same as the Afghan policy. He's done nothing with either of them. He's talking vaguely about getting out, beginning to turn around. But the only way out is to get out. And I don't know why that's so hard for America. I don't know why. You know, there's, what can I tell you? There's no learning curve. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. We always go in places where we don't know the culture. And please, a lot of people here will not agree with the thing I say. I hope you do ask me questions and make it clear you don't, because that'll make it fun. Yes, let's go on.
I have one, which bears what you've just said, that in what you've said, the U.S. really hasn't done much that's right. What do you think we should be doing in Libya, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan that would make things a little bit better?
Well, I think the first thing we should be doing is thinking about infrastructure in America and decaying schools and decaying roads. I'm serious. Washington's a bubble. Northwest Washington, where I live, is a bubble. Northeast Washington, Southeast Washington is not a bubble. There's the percentage of African Americans without jobs there is the same as everywhere else, 30-40%. College graduates now are looking at all races are looking at very dour numbers. There's a huge, you know what happened to the market today, 560 points. And I can tell you, on the trip to Europe, what was everybody saying to me? Get liquid. If you're not doing it, get liquid. It's not going to last long. I must say, I wish I had enough to worry about, but I don't. But so anyway, but everybody, the faith in America as an economic bastion is we still are very powerful. Please don't misunderstand. And one of the things that will come out of this, we will have a very fine-tuned army that knows how to hunt and kill people and does know how to fight terrorism. And we will have we should pare it down enormously. We still run 11 carrier groups. Do you know that? And we still have 80% of the Navy's of battleships and ships are amphibious for Marines landing at Iwo Jima again. It's amazing what we could do to the budget. It's amazing what we could do to the military budget, which is, So I would say the first thing is focus internally. The second thing is we're not helping. I don't think we've helped anything in Libya, the opposition, the rebels, there's 100 tribes or more in Libya. The Brits have done. The British intelligence really knows the most about it. And they've shared stuff with us, so I gather. I've heard about it. I haven't seen it. They've shared 102 tribes. Gaddafi always had enormous support from the tribes, many tribes. There was no way we were going to drive them out. The tribes in the tribes in the east were hostile, but most of those tribes, somebody used the figure 47 the other day in a conversation with me. He knew more about it than I did. The tribes that make up the rebel groups, and there's obviously a lot of fratricide and differences, are far more jihadist than the tribes on the other side. So we really don't know why we're supporting and who we're supporting in a civil war there. And the Egyptians have a lot to play in it that nobody really talks about. The Egyptians are deeply involved, and so is our intelligence services with opposition to Gaddafi at the same time. Gaddafi always has been a pain because he's basically off the wall, takes 20% off the top on oil, which aggrieves the oil companies, probably has a fortune of in the dozens, if not hundreds of billions, because he's got money stashed all over in gold, so I hear. He's not going anyplace. He's not going to go anyplace. We haven't been able to do it yet. We've obviously tried to kill him. And so what do you do there? What do you do? Do you have an international peace conference and bring it to a resolution? What did we do by going in NATO? Nobody can tell me anything positive. Nobody can tell me there's any good to be gotten out of Taliban. Yes, there's some terrible consequences of creating some sort of a coalition like the one in South Vietnam that'll be taken over by the Taliban. You're going to have discrimination against women again. There's going to be a lot of very serious collateral problems that nobody's going to like. But these are hard choices to make. Do we have the billions? The hundreds? It's 100 billion probably. I don't know the exact number, but it's many billions. Something like 10, 12 billion a month. It got easily 100 billion a year. Do we have that money to spend? No. We're fighting wars we can't afford to fight. And that's a reality. And in Iraq, what I'm talking about is the problems are really acute, and you're not getting a full sense of them. And look, this White House was given a terrible, terrible deal. It was left in a mess by the Bush administration, not only the economics, but also the politics. But he hasn't done as well as he could have. And I saw the paper quoted. I talked to a reporter. I mean, he should have. My friend from Mossad called me up after I did the story on Abu Ghraib. I did a bunch of stories for The New Yorker. And CBS actually had it, too. I just had the report, and I had other stuff. And so he called me up, and he said, this is a tough guy. This is a guy. He was going after Germans in Syria long before Eichmann. I mean, the Israelis did some very tough stuff once they got going about the Nazis. A lot has not been made public. He was doing some tough stuff. His language skills are great, German, Arabic, great English, free French. Anyway, so he calls me, and he says, Hirsch, what? You know, taking the men, the photographs, remember the pictures, humiliating them sexually or having them pretend to be masturbate on TV and the woman going up and down. He said, let me tell you something. He said, I hate Palestinians, and they hate me, and I've done terrible things to Palestinians, and they have done terrible things to me. But I got to say something here. He said, we're going to have to share a border with those sons of a bitches, and he probably used the worst language on that. That's what I remember him saying. And if we ever sexually humiliated Arabs the way you have, we couldn't deal with them. That's a line you just don't cross with the Arabs. Are you crazy? Do you know what you've done? He scared the hell out of me. Do you know what you've done? We don't know what we do often. You know, we do things, we don't know the consequences of it. America's a great, you know, I don't know. And I'm beginning to press myself. Let's go on.
Let me shift gears for a minute to talk about the media, which you've talked about. And how can the mainstream media play a more important role in presenting the real story, or what you consider the real story in the Middle East? And as part of that, how do you reconcile the need for clandestine operations, if there is a need, with the American love of openness?
Well, I've never been able to understand that. I mean, I've written a lot about the CIA. I always think, you know, there are a lot of good people there, and the CIA analysts are great. And most, by the way, most people in the government, American government, I should have said this right away, most of them, care absolutely as much for the right things as anybody, any place. They do. It just so happens that often it's very hard, particularly if you see something going wrong inside. It's very hard to do much about it because it takes a certain, you know, it takes a certain kind of person who's going to. It means exorcism. It means you're excised. You're gone, and so not many people want to do that. I'm hostile to the CIA because I don't think the president. I think presidents always find, as this one certainly has. I had somebody very wise tell me once years ago, 30, 40 years ago, who worked with a president very closely. He said, "You can't imagine what it's like. You think it's great to be president. You got Congress that can't do anything. You got so. You got all these fights. Look at Obama can't even this dumb stuff, excise stuff that's been voted. Yes, he could have invoked the 14th Amendment and started a big fight. I might have wanted him to do it." And, you know, go after the Tea Party. But he didn't. He chose, you know, he's a trimmer, in the old English phrase. He's a moderator. And that's always been his game. You know, he went through the 60s, not like everybody else in the 60s. He didn't share in that down with everything stuff we all did. And so he's a different person. And in any case, so here he is. They're frustrated. It's just really hard to be president. You can't get stuff done. The FAA, all this insanity with people walking out of jobs. And he can't, and he wants to fix it. He can't fix it. But what can he do? He can take a walk in the Rose Garden with the head of the CIA. And he can say, okay, go for it. And boy, you feel good about that. And so until you get rid of that part of it, you know, that's what they do. The CIA chief comes and says, I can do this for you. I can do this. And they do it. Dick Helms was particularly good at it. Bill Casey, as amoral as he was also good at that. Iran-Contra and all that stuff. We can sell arms, raise money. We can do all this stuff to the Contras. So I think in the record it shows that my own instinct is that if we didn't have a CIA and we didn't have a KGB, we would have come out the same place.